Thanks for listening to this podcast. We as AMLC sometimes receive questions from our foreign partners about the way in which money laundering is combated in the Netherlands, in particular about the implementation of the EU anti-money laundering regulations in Dutch legislation. We have already published an informative Dutch podcast about this in 2021. You are now listening to a podcast completely translated from this Dutch podcast. It's translated and narrated by artificial intelligence. Despite care on our part, it is possible that some in particular legal terms have not been given exactly the same legal meaning or connotation. The sole purpose of this podcast is to give our foreign partners in anti-money laundering a first impression of the Dutch approach to anti-money laundering, and we think that this podcast is perfectly suitable for that purpose, even though some English terms in this podcast may not have exactly the same legal meaning. Nice of you to listen to this podcast from the AMLC. I am Eric Reisenweber and have already made several AMLC podcasts on specific forms of money laundering. Today we go back to basics. What exactly is money laundering? I have sometimes noticed that some people include fraud under money laundering. But is that actually true? And where does money laundering start and where does it end? You can of course find all about money laundering on our website, but today we discuss it with Sophie de Ridder. Sophie has been working as an AML specialist at the AMLC for almost 8 years now, so we've been colleagues for a while now too. Bye, Sophie. Thanks for your contribution to this podcast.
Hi, Eric. Nice to be here.
Let's get straight to the point. What exactly is money laundering?
Good question. Money laundering is actually a very broad offense, and at its core, you could say it is about hiding or concealing and giving a seemingly legal status to an object that comes from a crime. And the purpose of that is so that the criminal can then go and spend or invest that in the upper world without being noticed. So if you want to put it very succinctly, it is about something that has been obtained from a criminal offense, and an attempt is made to disguise its criminal origin by making it appear as if there is actually a legal origin for that object when there is none at all. That can stem from all sorts of other offenses. So money laundering is always related to other forms of crime as well. That can be very broad. There is actually no limit to that. So we can talk about drug trafficking, but it can also be about environmental crimes from corruption abroad to tax evasion. It can be very broad.
Is it always about very large sums of money or not?
Not necessarily. There is no kind of definition in the penal code about what the minimum amounts should be. Investigation-wise, it does of course make more sense to look at somewhat larger cases than someone who is laundering 10 euros. We do make a choice about that.
Why do we fight money laundering? Sounds weird, because of course we don't want crime. But what exactly is the importance of fighting money laundering? Can you comment on that?
Money laundering is actually a very effective offense, you could say, to start fighting and detecting. Because a lot of forms of crime are ultimately money-driven. Not all of them, of course, but a very wide range of crimes are. People do it not for fun, but because they can make money out of it. If you think back to those crimes I mentioned earlier, they all have in common that they are ultimately about making a profit, in a way that is not legal, in a criminal way. By combating money laundering, it makes it harder for those people to start using those criminal profits. So that's why it's a very effective crime to focus on that, because if you can fight that money laundering properly and make it difficult for people, in the end, it doesn't pay. Crime should not pay, we sometimes say. And money laundering helps with that.
Do you have some examples of ways to launder money?
There are a legion of examples, actually. You could say the sky is the limit with money laundering, and that's what makes it so interesting, because there are always new examples coming up. I can name a few. These can include, for example, smuggling money through all sorts of different countries and companies, and then legitimizing it with fake invoices. Of course, that's a pretty easy way that makes it look like there's a legitimate reason for that money, by creating a fake invoice.
You act as if you have a lot of income from legitimate business.
Yes, exactly. You make it look like you delivered something to someone in a certain country, write an invoice for it. But actually, it's about criminal money. It can also very often involve loans, which is a well-known way of doing things. We sometimes call that the loan-back construction. It is a variant of that. It involves someone actually lending money back to himself. He makes it look like he is getting money legally through a legal loan. But actually, that money is brought there by himself first and lent back to him. So loan back in that way, that it looks like it comes from another party, while it is actually criminal money from himself.
Yes, so he is actually the other party as well.
Exactly. You see that very often in money laundering, that the parties have to play together to get that money laundering done, or are actually one and the same, while it looks like it is someone else, but it is actually the same person.
Clear.
An example could also be, for example, with art they row or horse trading. What is actually the common denominator in that is that it is difficult to say what those goods are worth. For example, it could be someone who places an advertisement for the sale of a painting and pretends to have obtained their criminally obtained assets by selling that painting, when in fact that was never delivered or never there. There are an awful lot of ways of money laundering. These are just a few examples. It is super diverse, money laundering. People sometimes immediately think of very large, complex constructions, as we sometimes read in the newspapers, of course. But that doesn't always have to be the case. But in any case, it is true that it pays for criminals to set up these money laundering schemes, of course, because that way they can make use of that money.
The examples involve only acts aimed at hiding the origin of assets. Is that the complete picture of money laundering?
No, definitely not. There is more to money laundering than cover-up and concealment. To better understand the money laundering process, it is often divided into different stages. So then we talk about the process of money laundering. That is not really a legal definition of money laundering, but more of an economic or criminological definition. That phase model can be very helpful in understanding money laundering better. You see someone doing something, and those phases can then help you think, oh, maybe someone is doing this to achieve a certain goal, one of those phases in that money laundering process.
Please tell more about these phases.
We ourselves use a 4-stage classification. Then it involves the phases of placement, veiling, justification, and spending. Sometimes a 3-phase model is also adhered to, and then justification and spending are taken in one as the integration. But as said, I usually adhere to 4 phases.
So what do we mean by placement?
Let's start with that. Placement is indeed the first phase, and its purpose is actually to get the criminal money into the financial system.
Is that always cash?
Yes, that is a good question. That placement phase does often see cash. A lot of forms of crime end up producing cash. That is not always easy for the criminal, because a lot of cash, that stands out. That is why this placement phase, which precedes money laundering, you might say, is to bring that cash into the system. It is already part of money laundering, but a first stage to get rid of that cash, this can be done, for example, by depositing with a bank. And because companies and banks obviously have to be very careful these days about this kind of conspicuous behavior, it is often chosen to then break that down into smaller amounts. So one large amount is deposited in smaller portions into different accounts, or into the same one, in order to stay under such a reporting limit, and we call that smurfing. So that is a way that is used a lot. But it may also involve not so much putting the cash in that account, but part of this phase may also involve someone taking it abroad. So then we are actually talking more about relocation than placement, because in other countries it can sometimes be easier to get it into a bank account, or because the money has to go to another country.
And does that move already fall under money laundering, since it hasn't been posted yet?
Yes, that can legally be part of money laundering, for example, by going abroad with criminal money. If I have assets obtained from corruption, and I then go to great lengths to hide its criminal origin,
then you might skip the placement as a step. That could be, or not.
That would certainly be possible. Another example is someone who embezzles money in employment, and that money is already in an account, and he transfers it to another private account, which is not allowed in this case. Then the money is already in the financial system, so then we are no longer talking about the placement phase. We are then at the concealment phase, which was the second one.
We are now covering it in chronological order, but if I understand correctly, it is not necessarily necessary that you go through all those stages, is it? To be clear.
Yes, that is certainly true, so it is indeed convenient to treat it chronologically, because there is a logical order to the different phases. But in practice, it is certainly not the case that the criminal always neatly adheres to the phase model as conceived. That sometimes makes it difficult to prosecute. So the second stage is obfuscation. In it, the aim is actually to make the traceability of criminal money more difficult. So to more obscure the link between that criminal money, the criminal origin, and where it eventually goes. So that's why obfuscation. That's why smoke screens are put up.
So what should I think about?
Yes, that could be about shuffling the money around, back and forth, across different accounts. may involve setting up all kinds of legal entities, which of course we often see. Things to disguise who is actually the ultimate person behind this, the ultimate beneficial owner, we call it. For example, by setting up all kinds of legal entities, using cat catchers and then passing the money back and forth between them, so that it's just harder to see, oh, here it once started and now it has gone here. That flow of money is not as linear, so to speak, as we would like it to be easy. They try to make it difficult.
Clearly. And then you mentioned justification.
Yes, justification is a very important phase of money laundering and actually a part we often think about. If I just gave those examples at the very beginning about making invoices or loan back constructions, then we are actually talking about that justification phase. So in this phase, it's about devising something that suddenly makes it seem as if there is a legal origin for that object, while that legal origin is not there at all.
Yes, that is not the case with concealment. You just overbook, but...
Yes, exactly. So at that concealment, it is made more difficult to follow, and with justification, something new is suddenly created, which was never there, to make it look like that money was legally earned. And so the options for this are actually endless. And that's kind of where the challenge for fighting money laundering lies, because criminals can always come up with something new for this, and we all have to run after it, sort of.
So important to pierce through it. Yes, you do come up with this bill, but there are weird dates on it, for example. Is that a way you can pierce that?
Yeah, sure.
So it is very important that people in financial institutions are alert to that, and also in all kinds of other industries that can be abused. So they need to know in what way they might be abused for such a justification being created. Clear.
Then there is concealed and justified. So then you basically have white money. Well, of course, it never really becomes white. We say it remains criminal. But in any case, we then come to the final stage, spending. And that one is, of course, the easiest, you might say. Then it just involves spending that money in the upper world. So someone can start disposing of it at that point without being too conspicuous.
Spending laundered money also falls under money laundering?
Yes, definitely. So that final phase where it can be reinvested in the business again, for instance, new goods can be bought with it, or just a whole luxury lifestyle can be lived with it. That is the final phase of money laundering.
Okay, clear. Still, those are pretty complicated steps now and then. A criminal has to try pretty hard to disguise its origin. How does that work in practice?
Yes. Fortunately, it does involve some steps, and it is not always so incredibly easy to do, and the more barriers are put up, the harder it becomes to launder. It is also certainly the case that criminals spend a lot of money on it. Money laundering costs money, and it involves all sorts of people to start getting it done. That can take very complex forms and take a while to start getting that money that way, but it certainly doesn't always have to be so complex.
But you say several people will be involved. All of them, then, have to be paid. So it is not necessarily clear who committed the crime themselves. A money laundering operation can also be carried out by someone who was not himself the criminal?
Yes, I see what you mean. Indeed, people can be involved in money laundering without ever having been involved in drug trafficking, corruption, or environmental crimes themselves. But assisting in money laundering is in itself another criminal offense. So that then draws you into crime if you knowingly assist in that.
We'll discuss that a little further later. Do you want to add anything to those phases first?
Yes, I do think it is good to realize that it is ultimately a theoretical model. So that's how we look at the money laundering process to understand it better, as I said. You see that someone keeps depositing money in small amounts, and then it can help to think maybe that's because someone is trying to place the money. But it remains a theoretical model at the end of the day. So it doesn't mean that criminals are obviously always sitting around going through, well, I'm going to go through phase one first and then two, and only then am I going to spend. In reality, it is, of course, sometimes the case that phases are skipped or that someone starts with justification of creating invoices and only then starts obfuscating, or indeed, as we said earlier, that the money is already in the financial system, so the placement is skipped altogether. So it's a model to better understand and recognize money laundering. But it's not a legal definition of money laundering, so it's also not like we have to stick entirely firmly to that now of, oh, someone skipped this step. It's not money laundering anymore. That's not how you should see it.
Clear. Now let's look at that legal definition of money laundering. What does it look like?
Yes, of course. As a lawyer, I always find that a fun question. Money laundering is quite an extensive offense in terms of how it is criminalized.
And since when is that?
That happened in 2001, when it was incorporated into the Dutch Penal Code.
That's not even that long yet, is it?
No, for criminal law, it is not long at all. Money laundering is a relatively new offense. That is because, until then, the Netherlands often used receiving stolen goods. Receiving stolen goods is very similar to money laundering, if we look at the text in the Penal Code. Because receiving stolen goods is also about having objects derived from crime.
Receiving stolen goods still exists as a separate offense?
Yes, definitely. Receiving stolen goods still exists, and sometimes you do see some confluence between them. Sometimes you have to choose. Do we want to prosecute receiving stolen goods or money laundering? So money laundering was included in the Dutch legal code in 2001. And we also see that there is increasing harmonization from a European level to criminalize money laundering within all kinds of European countries. And that this criminalization should also include reasonably certain definitions. So certain things must be punishable as money laundering and must also carry certain minimum penalties. We see this very much reflected in, if you look at the text of the money laundering article, because it's sometimes somewhat difficult to understand. This is also because there are so certain things that must necessarily be in it.
And which article are we talking about?
Then we are talking about 420 bis of the Penal Code. That is intentional money laundering. And what might be a good one to add is that money laundering was criminalized with the aim of protecting integrity of financial and economic operations. So that was the objective behind that. And there is then an attempt to counteract the fact that the proceeds of crime remain out of sight of justice and that criminal objects are given a seemingly legal status. So that's the objective that was given when this article was introduced, 480 bis.
And how does that article read?
I can read it out. It is a piece of text, but we are going to read something anyway. Under one, we see, if guilty of money laundering, shall be punished with imprisonment for a term not exceeding 6 years, or a fine of the fifth category. And then we see under A, he who conceals or disguises from an object, its true nature, origin, place of finding, disposal, or movement, or conceals or disguises who is the rightful owner of an object, or has it in his possession, while he knows that the object comes directly or indirectly from any crime. Then under B we have he who acquires, possesses, transfers, or converts an object, or makes use of an object, while he knows that the object comes directly or indirectly from any crime. And then we have another one, and it defines what is to be understood by objects. Objects means all things and all property rights.
So it does require the person laundering to know that the dispersal is felony, I understand.
Yes, that is a very important part. There are several offense components, that's what we call it, so components of money laundering that are in this whole article, and they all have to be present for it to be money laundering.
Yes. We were talking about those four phases of money laundering. They really come into it too, huh? In the terminology of these articles of law.
Yes, you saw that very well. Those are indeed reflected in this. For example, you can indeed see that there is talk of hiding or concealing the origin or the real nature. Of course, that could be that justification, or concealing or hiding who the right holder is. There is that verse lawyerness in that, trying to shield that ubo. And the spending, of course, comes back in sub B, so we see those phases coming back in there in all sorts of ways. But it's pretty broadly defined money laundering. It's not that it only falls under that which people often think of. Having that phase model, that's more in line, I think, with what people often think about money laundering. While it is a bit broader than just that, you don't have to catch a criminal in disguise if they are just posting. In fact, that is already punishable too.
And if a criminal only pays for an expensive watch out of criminally obtained assets, that criminal can therefore already be convicted in principle.
In some cases it does, indeed. So then we are not so much talking about that cloaking, but more about the spending phase.
There seem to be several variants of money laundering listed in the criminal law. What is the exact situation?
Yes, there are a lot of laundering law articles by now, so it doesn't stop at 420 Bs. Meanwhile, we have a number of them. So first you have intentional money laundering. That's what I just read out, 420 Bs. Then we have debt money laundering, and that looks at someone being involved but having less knowledge, i.e. knowing less than deliberate money laundering. The issue then is that the accused had to suspect money laundering. And then we have habitual money laundering and an aggravated form of money laundering, actually an aggravated version of intentional money laundering. That carries an 8-year prison sentence.
When is habitual laundering compared to intentional laundering then?
For habitual money laundering, you need intentional money laundering in any case. And on top of that, it has to be proved that someone has made a habit of it. And we are not talking about someone who is a repeat offender, for instance. He was previously convicted of money laundering and is now convicted again. We are talking about a larger laundering operation within a single structure, which involves multiple laundering operations. Both time and frequency can play a role in this. Someone may set up a construction and use it for several years. Or it may be someone who sets up a very large structure in a short time and uses it very often. In any case, there must be some form of habit in it. It should not be a one-off act.
Does this then refer specifically to professional money launderers offering their services to criminals? Or is this also quite common among criminals themselves?
That can occur in both. So it may involve, as we call it, a facilitator. As you just described, someone who offers his services for that purpose and makes a habit of it. But it can also involve the criminal himself, and that facilitator is actually also very much covered in the next article, which is money laundering by profession or business. That's actually paragraph 2 of the article Habitual Money Laundering. And money laundering by profession or business is a relatively new, actually even newer article than the others, and that has been added to cover people who have their role to prevent money laundering. So, gatekeepers within anti-money laundering legislation, and don't live up to that role but abuse their position to help those money launderers. So then we can think of lawyers, tax advisors, accountants who should actually help prevent money laundering and instead help criminals launder their money. We call that money laundering in the course of a profession or business, and that is also a criminal aggravated form of intentional money laundering.
So if I help to launder a criminal's money, but I am not covered by anti-money laundering legislation, I am not covered by this article.
Again, it is not that sharp. In the end, that is not included in the article itself. So there, the article itself only states that it concerns someone who does so in the course of his profession or business. But the explanatory memorandum, which is a kind of explanation of the laws before they are introduced, does list all kinds of institutions that fall under the anti-money laundering regulations. As I just said, lawyers, tax advisors, etc.
But it may be broader in practice.
It may be broader in practice, but this article has not actually been used much since it was introduced. So to be honest, I don't know exactly what it should cover either.
There would still have to be case law on it.
There would still have to be case law on it.
But the Dutch bank ING, for example, was it not prosecuted under this article?
No, ING did not ultimately settle for money laundering on appeal or business, but for debt laundering, so they did not fall under that.
We were now at the fourth, but we still have two to go, right?
Correct. Indeed, we have two more to go. A lot of different articles. The last two are 420B.1 and 420KWater.1, and those are the two newest articles. They were only introduced in 2017. Then they are simple intent money laundering and simple debt money laundering. And that simple, that refers to the situation where someone has or acquires items directly from their own crime. So it's a very specific subpart, and even more like a subvariant of intentional money laundering. I can explain a bit more about it later.
Moving on now to the components, an investigator must prove to enable conviction for money laundering. How about that?
Yes, exactly. Because I just mentioned all these different offenses, and of course, they all always have separate pieces in them that have to be proven in order to get a conviction for money laundering. And we call those pieces file parts. The money laundering article, as I just read it out, is, of course, super broad. And I can imagine that that would be difficult to follow to hear that in one piece.
Fortunately, we're going to break that down a bit now.
Yes, exactly. It always helps to chop it up into different pieces. And you could say there are four main components. Then they are the object, the money laundering act, the criminal origin, and the science. Let's start with the object. That is actually defined in paragraph 2 of 24 bis. It literally says there that it covers all objects and all property rights. So that means it is very broadly defined. By things, you can mean all tangible things. And by property rights, we mean rights that are transferable or that give benefit to those entitled. An easy example, of course, is scriptural money.
But it could also be shares, for example, perhaps?
Yes, it can also be equities. And actually, it is so broadly defined that it can cover an awful lot. So you can do money laundering with money, which people often think of. In English, of course, it's also called money laundering. But it can be much broader than that. It can involve houses, cars, expensive watches, but also think of the new cryptocurrencies, NFTs. I myself worked at the NVBA for a while. There, we even looked at meat laundering by making it look like it was different kind of meat, e.g. horse meat labeled as beef. So there is actually no limitation to it.
Okay, so basically anything that has value, or where you try to siphon off value, so to speak.
Yes, definitely. And then the next one is the Money Laundering Act. That actually takes up most of the offense article, or the law article, because that Money Laundering Act, those are described under sub A. There are some, and we have some under sub B. You have to think of it as a kind of menu of choices. You don't have to prove all of them, but there has to be at least one Money Laundering Act. There may also be several, as we looked at that phase model.
So does the penalty get higher if there are several, or does it not matter so much?
That is not one-to-one, so to speak, whether it gets higher or lower from that. It will rather depend on the amount, what is being laundered, or what exactly someone has done.
Okay, so at least one of the following constituents you are about to mention.
It must include at least one of these money laundering acts. Under A, it is always about concealment or disguise. So there are several things there that can be concealed or disguised, but it must always be about concealing or disguising. So it involves hiding or concealing the true natura, origin, location, disposition, or displacement, or who is the rightful owner of it, or who owns it. But there must always be concealment or disguise of it.
Yes, the concealment of the right holder I do find interesting to zoom in on. Because then it means, then, that if you set up a construction with private limited companies that are busy channeling away criminal money, and then the action is to conceal the fact that that particular oligarch is behind it, for example, I'm just mentioning, so that is also a money laundering act in itself.
Yes, that is indeed a money laundering act. Of course, you then also have to have those other file components to speak of money laundering, but that could indeed be a money laundering act.
So just setting up such a structure without, say, criminally obtained assets is not a money laundering act.
Ultimately, then, it is not money laundering, because there must always be criminal assets. So the offense components, you do have to prove all of them.
So yes, it is basically a money laundering act, but because there are no other ingredients in it, you cannot already speak of money laundering.
Yes, correct. And because the money laundering actions are formulated very broadly, it is of course essential that they ultimately relate to that criminal asset. Otherwise, everything will fall under this at some point. So you have to look at them all together. In any case, subsection A is about hiding or disguising that object. It is not necessary that it is completely concealed, so that you can never find out again. So it is not necessary that the intention to conceal is completely successful. That would, of course, also make it impossible to ever detect money laundering. Because then, we would only be able to continue it when we can no longer see it.
Yes. Even if we find out that they were fake invoices, it will still have been a cover-up, even if it is a failed attempt.
Yes, exactly. That is indeed correct. So, it is sufficient if some kind of fog curtain is raised. Now, I have focused a lot on concealing and hiding, but we also have the actions under sub B, and that is precisely what makes money laundering such a broad offense. Because people often think of the actions under sub A, but we also have sub B. And like I said, it's kind of a menu of options. So you don't necessarily have to choose to conceal or hide. You can also opt for the money laundering actions under B. And these are very broadly defined. This concerns acquiring, possessing, transferring, converting, or using. And what is meant by that is actually how those words also have meaning in everyday language. So if you were to look up in the dictionary, what does use mean? That's also what it means here. So that could simply be someone using the money to go on holiday, or a car that comes from crime by driving around in it, or have the money available by hiding it in the old sock, or by giving it to someone else, transferring it. So those are very broad formulations.
So you must have that business or asset yourself.
Yes, these actions are more like actually having possession of the object, so at least have some form of control over it. It is, of course, also possible that someone has money in an account. Yes, it is out of your hands, but you do have control over it if you have access to that account. If you have that money in your own account, it also falls under this article of law, even if it is difficult to tangibly put away in a container somewhere.
Yes, okay. Did you want to add anything to B, or should we move on to science?
Yes, I think it's okay to move on to the next file part. So in addition to those actions, there are two other components, the science and the criminal origin. And it is actually easier to first talk about the criminal origin.
I follow you.
We talked about the object that must be there and that a money laundering act must be committed with it. But something important is going on with that object, namely, that object must have a criminal origin. So it must have come from some crime. If that is not the case, then there can be no money laundering. This means that another offense must always have been committed first, another crime, in order to subsequently be able to launder it. There is no money laundering without these other crimes.
Just for my understanding, I hear you using misdemeanor and delinquent interchangeably. Is that the same?
No, it doesn't have to be exactly the same. That's a very good point. It must be a crime. So a violation is not enough. So the article says it has to come from some crime. And that could be any crime. So that could be anything. It may also be a crime that was committed by someone else or that was committed in a very distant past, a very long time ago. Whether the crime took place abroad is not a problem. But it must be a crime, so a violation is not enough.
Do you think that, for example, an employee at a bank who does KYC or transaction monitoring, is it important that such a person also understands exactly what a crime is, or to be able to recognize money laundering?
I don't think so, because for such an employee, it is ultimately about reporting unusual transactions. And for this, it is not necessary to establish 100% that it concerns money laundering or a crime. So there is no need for this to be proven. It is, of course, important for the detective or the officer to ultimately obtain a conviction for money laundering, that it must be a crime and not a violation.
So in a lawsuit, when it comes to money laundering, it must always be established that the object has a criminal origin.
Yes, exactly. You are absolutely right. That object must have a criminal origin, and we must ultimately determine that. That object can come from there directly or indirectly. The text says immediately or indirectly.
Yes, what is that difference?
Yes, the difference is that immediate means direct and medium means indirect. So if you take a very simple example, someone steals money, that money comes directly from the theft. But suppose that something is subsequently purchased with that money, an expensive watch or a house, then that object is indirectly, i.e., indirectly derived from some crime. And both objects can then be part of the money laundering offense. So then we can see for both what is most useful to choose as an object.
Okay. That's how we discussed criminal origins, right? But science, is it important that someone knows whether the object has a criminal origin? What does that mean?
This is very important because it is not enough that an act is committed with the object and that the object has a criminal origin, but the money launderer must also know, while committing that act, that the object originates from a crime. So that is why it is easier to first look at that criminal origin in the discussion and then talk about the science, because that science relates to that criminal origin. So we often talk about intent in criminal law. It is not enough that that action is only intentional, i.e. that someone is deliberately hiding that object. But that intent must also relate to the criminal origin. The article actually states, even though he knew that the object came from some crime...
How does a detective show that someone knows something? You can't look into someone's head, can you?
Yes, that actually applies to money laundering as it does to all kinds of other criminal offenses. So the setup here isn't exceptional or anything like that. And then we just look at its external characteristics. So, for example, it could be because someone confesses that in an interrogation that he knew that. That's a very easy example. But we may see that someone has signed certain documents or that it is obvious based on appearance that it concerns criminal money. Take money that comes from an explosive robbery and has ink all over it.
Well, these are all very clear examples.
Sometimes it can, of course, become a bit more complicated, but the bottom line is that we objectively determine that any normal thinking person would say, well, you knew in this case.
Clearly. We also talked about debt laundering. That is not about the person who committed the crime. So it is wise. I am not looking at the detective right now. But if you become involved in something like that yourself, to always be aware of where could that money come from. Just to mention, if I buy something via Marktplatz or something, can I also become involved in money laundering?
That could possibly be possible. It is, of course, always important that you are aware that you do not just get involved in something. Of course, you don't have to worry that you suddenly become a money launderer without having done anything. But if there is a lot of reason to think something is not right here, and I think everyone has had a kind of gut feeling somewhere that says, well, This is very strange. If someone offers you a bicycle for a few euros in the middle of the night, and then you can know, well, that shouldn't be quite right, a good bike for only 2 euros. Too good to be true. But then we are indeed talking about a somewhat lighter version about guilt. And that is a separate article. So 420b states, while the suspect knew that the object originated from any crime, here it says that someone had to reasonably suspect that. Yes, there had to be something to make you believe that there was reason to ask questions, that someone has buried their head in the sand, and well, if you still think, I don't care, I'll take it just for granted, and I'm going to spend this money anyway. Yes, then you become involved in money laundering.
For a detective, there is, of course, a difference between being able to demonstrate that someone knew that it originated from a crime and actually being able to demonstrate that a crime was the basis. Those might be two different things, correct?
Yes, yeah, so those are also the two different elements of the offense, and they must both be present. So the object must have originated from a crime, and someone had to know that in the case of intent or reasonable suspicion, in the case of guilt. Yes, okay, I think that's clear. But what I was wondering is, should a detective, for example, also be able to prove the crime itself? No, it doesn't have to be that way. So the crime that exists in addition to the money laundering, as I said before, there must always have been another crime. And we often call that the predicate offense. So what that object originated from, the crime that was committed, we often call that the predicate crime. And that does not need to be proven in the Netherlands. So we just have to prove that it came from some crime. But there is no need to prove which specific crime occurred.
A separate podcast has been made about this subject. It is available to investigators via SoundCloud. That's a different topic because it goes beyond the scope of this podcast.
There is still a lot to say about this. We often call this the six-step plan. And in this way, it is possible to get a conviction for money laundering without having to prove a specific predicate offense. And because you, of course, have to prove that it is based on any crime, you sometimes find yourself in a kind of deadlock. How am I going to do that? And that step-by-step plan can help with that.
It is indeed easy to make a completely separate podcast about that, so one can already be found on our website. Suppose someone steals a bicycle, and that is clearly demonstrable, so you can convict him for it. Would you then choose to try to punish him for money laundering, for example, concealing the origin, and not for stealing the bicycle? And someone could perhaps be prosecuted twice because he committed money laundering and stole that bicycle.
Yes, this subject has played a very important role for a long time because you started to encounter the fact that money laundering is so broadly defined that it can indeed be the case that someone commits a certain offense, a crime, and then immediately becomes guilty. Engages in money laundering, while in fact not much else has happened. Indeed, the simplest example you just stated, if someone steals something, he has that object in his possession, or available. And that object comes from a crime, namely theft. And that person knows that too, because he just stole it. You therefore meet all the components. So then there is money laundering and that other crime at once, while in fact not much else has happened. The Supreme Court indicated at one point that that was not the intention. That should not be the meaning of money laundering. The Supreme Court determined it meets all the components, but it does not qualify as money laundering. And that is why it is called the qualification exclusion ground. That's another broad topic. The Supreme Court made many rulings on this around 2015 because they created an extra legal exception. We do not read this in the article of the law, but the Supreme Court nevertheless found that it does not qualify as money laundering. What is very important is to see that this is an exception. So sometimes detectives think, but that's not possible, is it? You can't launder your own items, right? We cannot speak of money laundering because that person also committed that crime, that predicate offense himself. But that conclusion is also incorrect because it is an exception. For that exception, it is very important to have a good overview of the different components.
So then we are talking about an object that comes directly from one's own crime and that only involves acquiring or possessing it. Only then does the qualifying exclusion ground apply.
Exactly. So those are quite specific examples. Examples where this indeed concerns automatic doubling. So someone steals that bike and then does nothing with it. Then we may be talking about the qualification exclusion ground. But all kinds of other examples that we mentioned earlier. someone who sets up a loan back construction or makes all kinds of invoices or brings money abroad, then we are not talking about the qualifying exclusion ground. Someone can certainly launder his own objects and be convicted for it. But in some cases, this qualification ground for exclusion applies. And that means that suddenly something extra has to be proven that we do not see in the legal text.
And does a ruling by the court have the same expressive power as a legal text? Or can such a ruling by the court still be overruled?
Yes, that's a nice question. Ultimately, the Supreme Court has given an interpretation of the legal text here. So they basically create something where they say it should be read like this. That is what the legislator intended. Because, yes, such a text is there, but then the question is, what exactly does that mean? So in that sense, the Supreme Court has the power to say what the meaning is.
In a subsequent court case, you can fall back on such a ruling by the Supreme Court, right?
Of course. That, in turn, has expressive power in other statements. But what is very important is to say that the legislator itself has now spoken out about this again, and has said, we actually want this to be punishable. And that is why the two new offenses that I mentioned earlier were introduced in 2017. Simple intentional money laundering and simple debt laundering. And the possession or acquisition of an object that comes directly from one's own crime is punishable as simple money laundering. In those cases, the penalty is much lower, and we are talking about months instead of years.
But the point of it is that that money can still be taken, and someone can still be convicted. That wasn't possible before with just the offense.
Not at the time when that qualification was perhaps applied, because then an acquittal would follow.
And could someone no longer be punished twice with that addition?
It is, of course, possible to prosecute someone for both. So it is possible to use simple money laundering in addition to the predicate offense. So someone is prosecuted for the basic offense and for simple money laundering. It is possible to prosecute someone for simple money laundering alone. And it is also possible to use simple money laundering as a kind of backstop. Suppose the public prosecutor is of the opinion that in principle there is intentional money laundering, but to be on the safe side, he then charges. In the alternative, we call this simple money laundering. So then it is a kind of backup, and all combinations are actually possible.
Thank you so much. Finally, I would like to ask, do you see any changes in the future for money laundering and its prosecution?
Yes, I think money laundering is always evolving. I do not expect any more new anti-money laundering legislation to be introduced in the short term. But of course, there are always developments in the fight against money laundering. So then we can talk about working more internationally and tackling money laundering better. And, well, of course, money laundering can take on all kinds of forms. So then we can talk about cryptos or NFTs. Money laundering can actually continue to go in all kinds of directions, I think.
Thank you, Sophie, Eric, for the clear explanation. If you didn't know much about money laundering yet, it's quite something. But this podcast doesn't wear out. Feel free to listen to it again if you want. Thanks for the clear explanation. Good luck in your future work, Sophie.